Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRue Show. It's August 4th, 2007, and our topic today is how Mr. Lyndon LaRouche was right for 30 years. The financial system is finished. I will be the host today. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm in with the economics section of Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And I'm very glad that we have a colleague of mine for decades, I'll say, Richard Freeman. Welcome, Richard, here in the studio.
Thanks for having me, Marcia.
Because Richard has worked closely with Mr. LaRouche over this entire period and has been busy giving briefings this week as the events of the financial blowout process are taking place hour by hour or even faster. Another way you could put it, and as of 2 hours ago, Mr. LaRouche was on the air with a LaRouche Youth Movement meeting in California, and he said, we are in a new phase. Another way he's been putting it is, the party's over, the depression has begun, the depression is on, and it's just the beginning. Now, on discussing this, I want to welcome from our Washington, D.C. LaRouche Youth Movement Bureau, Aaron Newell. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
And he has a special angle on this, trying to bring reality and action out of Congress. Are they still in session? Because Cheney wants them to do something about wiretapping, Aaron, or not?
Well, we checked today, and they seem not to be in session. I don't know.
Okay.
I think they were supposed to have something on Monday.
And otherwise, we have a special guest from Houston, Texas, who's a part of the Western scene of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Welcome, Francisco Medina.
Hello.
Very clear. And you're a Californian otherwise, right?
Yes, I'm originally from the Los Angeles Youth Movement, and I'm here in Houston. We had the Young Democrats of America convention recently that we were deployed at, and I'm out here just helping develop the Houston process with the recruitment.
Oh, that's great. So we'll hear more from you for the hour, and we want to begin by taking note that many of you listening, wherever you may be in the world, may see some reflection of the breakdown process in the United States by what happened to the Mississippi River Bridge on August 1st during rush hour, namely up there in the upper Mississippi and the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. It fell into the river. With 50 or 60 cars, you see what happened. This bridge was from 1967. So before us all is the physical economic side of life that's been denied by especially the baby boomer generation for the last few decades. We're going to be discussing more about this in upcoming shows in August. But I just identify that as an image to keep in the back of our minds. A few hours ago, President Bush was there. He spoke for merely 3 minutes. I think that's probably his handlers, one of which was Karl Rove with the Minnesota Twins or whatever it's called, ball cap on. But what we've seen for hours and days since this happened is an incredible kind of callousness that can come out of the White House, out of the Bush who's in Cheney's control, over the situation of the danger and loss of life and the fact that the Cheney-ack viewpoint won't do anything about this. That is, it has obstructed rebuilding bridges. For 7 years, there was no plan to rebuild dams across the country. There's 3,500 unsafe dams. So we're going to get into this. We can talk about it, no problem today, but we're going to get into this some depth coming up. But this is what we've got, a kind of Cheney-ack grip. And the question is, we have an epic financial blowout and economic crisis on our hands. And Richard, where would you start to describe the key dynamics? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think one thing I'd just like to cite, Lyndon LaRouche is putting together a forward to a Democratic Party platform, and with each passing day breakdowns, this becomes more urgent. And in this platform, which he should have out, we hope, very, very soon and mass circulated because it's absolutely essential at this moment, he says the following. He says, the fact of the matter is, and this is from the forward of the platform, the fact of the matter is, at the one end, the respective mortgage-based securities markets, And at the opposite end, he's talking about bookend problems. And at the opposite end, the worldwide Cayman Islands-centered operations of the hedge funds. They are the bookends of a global financial system crisis, whose most notably complicating feature is the role of the Japan yen carry trade. The inability of the banks at the one end to play their assigned part in passing margins of money not being supplied to the current rash of hedge fund takeovers means a general breakdown of the system as a whole. And I think that that pinpoints for the last period what's going on. I mean, this is a crisis that didn't start yesterday, didn't start last month. It's been going on for many years.
But Richard, MSNBC tells us it's a market event, but you're saying no.
Not a market event. And the stock market is pretty much a reflection of what's going on. It's playing its role in bringing the breakdown upon us, but it's not the energizing feature. What Mr. LaRouche identified with the most recent, the hedge funds, the mortgage-backed securities, and the yen carry trade as being three of the crucial elements. Now, what I'd like to just say is this. First, in terms of the mortgage situation and the housing situation, this continues to get worse. It has not let up at all. In the first 6 months of this year, foreclosures were up 55% from the same period the year before. And we have new home sales down 22% in July compared to the same period the year before. And you have major one's called Beazer, BEAZER, which is it's one of the top 10, I think top 5 home building companies. And there are rumors all over the place that they will soon file for bankruptcy. So that gives you a sense that this situation just continues to worsen. In fact, I just want to say on the foreclosures, it's reported officially that there may be 1.5 million. But an analyst from Bloomberg said that it's really closer to probably 2 million by the end of 2008. And a fellow by the name of Mark Zandi, Z-A-N-D-I, who writes for Economy.com, which is now owned by Moody's, he put out an analysis last week saying that there's actually going to be 2.5 million foreclosures by the end of 2008-2009, plus a 10% further drop in housing prices, which would be the worst that we've ever seen since 1931, the Great Depression. Now, that continues, but what has happened is that this collapse of the mortgages and foreclosure process has led to the collapse of mortgage-based securities, which are based, and packaging of mortgages, which has led to the collapse of these strange operations called CDOs or collateralized debt obligations. But that has now spread to the entire financial system, and it's causing seizures to occur throughout the whole system. What I want to just look at is two stress points. There's actually more, of course, but two that I think are pivotal. One is the collapse of the investment banks, led by Bear Stearns, but also including Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch, who are central pivots to this whole operation. And they are in much worse shape than anyone's willing to admit at this point. And the second thing is what's happening with the leverage buyouts and the junk bonds, because those are instruments which are very, very central to that. So let me just take one side of this, which is the credit supply side, which LaRouche mentioned as one of the two bookends, because that's not going into, it's not being supplied on the level of which it was thought to be necessary. And just say that I'll get to the Japanese yen carry trade. In July, the level of corporate bonds as a whole was $98 billion. Versus in June, $289 billion. This was what was issued worldwide. So that's a collapse of two-thirds. The junk bonds, which were issued, in June it was $22.5 billion. I'll mention June first this time. And in July it was $2.4 billion, a collapse of 90%. Now the importance of that is that these are the instruments that are used in takeovers and mergers and acquisitions. To locate that, during the last year, there were $4 trillion of mergers and acquisitions. In the first 6 months of 2007, there were $3 trillion, of which reportedly $1.1 trillion, or one-third, were leveraged. Actually, the figure is much higher. So you had $3 trillion of these mergers and acquisitions which were being carried out this year, which would have been a $6 trillion figure if it had been carried out for the full year. This is what drives the insanity of the stock market. There's no value in the stock market. It's a fictitious set of values, as are most of the financial paper we'll be discussing this afternoon. But what that has meant is that if you make a merger and acquisition in, let's say, one sector, the auto supply sector or the machine tool sector or you know, the food chain sector, and somebody makes a play for one of the companies, what happens is not just that company that's the subject of the takeover, but all companies in that sector rise, and you get the sectors rising. And that has been pulling this operation up very dramatically over the last 2 years, particularly as they shifted money, the oligarchy shifted money into the stock market because of the collapse of the housing bubble. If this is taken away, and it is being taken away, and that's the last thing I just want to identify here, then the entire worldwide global mergers and acquisitions, which, as I said, was $3 trillion. I should have identified that as being worldwide for the first 6 months of this year, not just U.S. That starts to disappear. And what that has meant is that you have several investment banks and commercial banks that are on the hook for financing operations based on the such things as junk bonds and others, which we'll discuss. And they can't come up with the money. The junk bonds collapsed by 90%. The corporate bonds collapsed by 2/3, which means that they had offered, they already have $33 billion worth of deals, which they can't carry through on. These include the Alliance Boots, which is a takeover by KKR of Alliance Boots, which is the largest pharmacy chain in Britain. This includes a Cerberus takeover of Chrysler, which took an interesting turn yesterday. And this includes many other things like TXU, the big giant utility in Texas. Without this money, these investment banks were planning to sell off the money they were going to extend for these takeovers. Now they're stuck holding the money. So they're stuck, Marcia, to holding at least $33 billion of this money. But actually, in the pipeline was $500 billion, $289 billion in Europe, $206 billion in the United States. And this means that all of these markets, which were expecting on the banks to be able to syndicate their loans so that they could then make these mergers and acquisitions take place, they're stuck. These are going to be on their books. They can't handle it. And they're collapsing, many of the investment banks, right at this very second. So think of what that means globally for the whole mergers and acquisition. That part of the party, as Mr. Lewis said, is completely over.
So the game, the jig is up. The different games in the gaming house aren't working, you're saying.
Exactly. And if I could then just mention what this means, let us just take a look at three investment banks, which are very key. Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman Brothers. Now, they are another pivot in this whole operation, and they are going under. There is two ways of looking at how they're going under. First, the value of their stock. And so far this year, Merrill Lynch is down 22%, Lehman Brothers stock is down 21%, and Bear Stearns is down 33%. We'll have something special to say about Bear Stearns, because it's the fifth largest investment bank in the United States, perhaps the sixth or seventh largest in the world, and they are on the verge of going under. They just fired the chief of their bond operations, Warren Spector. There's a series of meetings this weekend, and he will probably be out by Monday, and this is part of this operation. But there's another way of looking at this, and this introduces some of these crazy elements. I won't go into them in depth, but just to identify for people what this involves. What you have are something called credit default swaps, which are very strange, very speculative, very risky instruments, which shouldn't be allowed. They just be illegal. Nonetheless, what happened is all three of those investment banks I just mentioned, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman Brothers, they, if you wanted to get insurance on bonds that they issued, that Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers or Merrill Lynch issued, you would have to pay, back in May, early June, $10,000 to $25,000 per every 10 million of bonds that they issued. Now, as of the last few days, you have to pay 115 to 150 in the case of Bear Stearns insurance, which is one form of way of expressing what a credit default swap is, for every 10 million issued. That is a 4- to 5-fold increase. And what Bloomberg reported, Bloomberg being a financial service, is that these companies are now junk bond. So these are three of the premier investment banks in the world. They're junk bond. Now, what they mean, just to identify this last point for our listeners, is they worked backwards. They said, what is the risk premium in terms of how much insurance would you have to pay on $10 million worth of bonds for a company that's junk bond? And they said, well, that's in the range of $115,000 to $120,000 per $10 million. And he said, well, lo and behold, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns are in that category. Therefore, by working backwards, their status is junk bond. And therefore, that starts to tell you that these investment banks are now on the edge of going. And they're not the only ones. Union Bank of Switzerland, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan Chase, which both does commercial and investment banking, they are in the same situation. If they go, the entire fulcrum or one of the fulcrums for all these funny money instruments working with the hedge funds, which they work with intimately, goes out as well.
Let me ask Aaron and Francisco, you can always throw something in here, but I would like Richard to spell one thing out, because you know you get singular events now. You can't predict everywhere. You're talking about the biggies and the famous names. And people should know we're having a write-up of this kind of thing as the feature article in the next EIR Online and the next hard copy Executive Intelligence Review. But a part of it includes a special report from Germany. Mm-hmm. That it's not a big name like Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, or something, but it's in English it was an industrial development bank or industrial lending bank. And Richard, that's just been the event of the hour in the last 10 days. Would you describe that?
Absolutely. And I just want to say that what I've identified with the debt for funding junk bond debt that finances this operation. Though, just one additional point, Marsh, is that not only is junk bond debt necessary for leverage takeovers and so forth and so on, buyouts, but it's also an instrument in the derivatives market. When LTCM went under, many of their positions, one half of the position, was in junk bonds. And the junk bond market was completely illiquid, which it is right now. When you can go from $22 billion of issuance to $2.4 billion of issuance, it's illiquid. And what that meant was that any derivative contract that had junk bonds in 1998, but is being repeated today, one half of the contract was junk bonds. You couldn't unwind the contract because you couldn't get anyone to buy the junk bonds, no matter what the price. So this has implications everywhere, but the junk bonds and the investment banks are just two breakdown points. They're far from being the only ones. Now, what Marcia just raised is this Deutsche Industriebank, which got involved in the U.S. subprime market through something called Rhineland Funding. And they had something called Lorelei Financing. And anyone who would be German would immediately know this, because Lorelei is the famous beauty that would lure sailors to their and fishermen onto the Rhine cliffs and to their destruction. But they chose that name themselves. And they got really badly burned on U.S. subprime operations. Now, 38% of this IKB, or this Deutsche Industriebank, is owned by the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau, which is the premier institution for funneling credit for productive purposes into the German economy, and was absolutely crucial for the German economic miracle, which rebuilt Germany after the war. Now, they had to come in with $8.1 billion, which is a heck of a lot. The damage is probably not over.
That was just a week ago or something.
The last 5 days. No, absolutely correct. And what happened was that there was a report, the German watchdog agency that's like our Securities and Exchange Commission is called, it's the initials are BAFIN, BaFin. And Joachim Sanyo, who's the head of BaFin, said that this intervention was necessary to, quote, prevent the worst banking crisis in Germany since 1931, end quote. And the French banking system is having huge problems right now. The Italian banking system is having huge problems right now because, as Lyndon LaRouche has said, the system is bankrupt. That has been settled for years. It was just what would be the triggering incidents that would set this process into explosion and, you know, and into breakdown.
Well, let's turn. We can continue discussion of this wild dynamic. In other words, it's all happening. But how do you think, Aaron, from your vantage point on Capitol Hill, day after day, this is perceived? by congressmen whose actual districts, you can mention Stephanie Tubb Jones, she's from Cleveland, and they're going to have, in her county, Cuyahoga County, 17,000 home foreclosures this year. But so this is the worst place in the country, it said, out of all 3,000 counties. But there you are with Mr. Cheney still in office and threatening all kinds of things. He's had a lot of press exposure this week, snarling about war. What do you think the perception is, or what's your view from Capitol Hill?
I think that a lot of congressmen are actually a little bit scared of the crisis. I know that what we've been doing, I mean, up in this past week, because we were initially in Washington about 2 weeks ago or so, we had a conference call with everybody around the nation to try and pinpoint congressmen on signing H.R. 333, the impeachment of Vice President Cheney. And, you know, we had a full-out plan. We were going to, you know, go into Congress every day, basically, and get these guys in the conversation about getting on and impeaching Cheney immediately. So we had been doing that the past week and a half or so. And then this whole system starts to blow out, and Lynn has to issue a plank saying that in D.C., we got to educate these congressmen, and that's the only way we're going to be able to get them to move on Cheney's impeachment. So the flank was reality, the fact that the whole system was now finished and it had been disintegrating. So this past week, past 2 days especially, since this came out, we've been going in there with LaRouche's new platform, his intro to it, and trying to engage congressmen and others in this crisis. And what the fact that if they leave in August, we're going to have a huge problem on our hands. The nation will. And they personally will have to deal with it. So, you know, we've been going in there trying to engage these guys, and we're finding that a lot of them are a little bit scared about the fact that this thing is coming down, and have very little understanding of what they're going to do. And I think it very much puts on the table LaRouche's platform and what he's writing up right now as a key emergency measure to be taken up.
But let me ask you another thing, Aaron or Francisco. If anyone's looked on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, there was an intention to start a special ongoing section on capital budgeting and taking emergency measures. I don't know if you know if that's up yet, but that's to aid what kind of thing you're describing, right, on this flank?
I didn't know about that particularly, but, yeah, I think it would help us a lot because one of the things that we do in terms of the D.C. operation to create the flank is we use the website as a key initiative to be able to bring in some of the things that go up on the website directly to the congresspeople and the staffers and just the general environment around the Congress so that day by day they're getting sort of the updated version of what we're trying to hit on, what's going to happen if they don't move on LaRouche's Economic Recovery Act.
Well, let me ask you, Santiago sent you an email, Aaron, where he says he's read on the LPAC site that about Representative Conyers' challenge or request for three more representatives to back Representative Kucinich's H.R. 333 for the impeachment of Cheney proceedings. And so he wants to ask you where things stand now. That may mean a restatement of what you just said, but I pass that along to you.
Well, we did get those two signers yesterday, but the fact is that what we get from reports from that office is that what was said by Conyers at this meeting was that if everybody in the room got three more signers,
okay,
then he would move on it.
So maybe you want to ask people to help out right now, right?
Yeah, we have to get everybody around the nation to call up every single person they know and put major pressure, because the thing that happens is pressure comes from the population. And what we do in D.C. is we sort of are creating sort of the necessity of why they have to move on impeachment, which is the financial crisis and the potential of another war launched by Cheney in this period.
I think that, this is Francisco, part of that pressure from the operations on the West Coast, particularly California, is that we've made lots of inroads into the Democratic Party there through just the LaRouche Youth Movement as a unit, and then our organization within the Democratic Party, the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Democratic Club, which I helped found there. One example, I mean, what Aaron had said about educating these people, I mean, that's our role. They wouldn't know this collapse is coming if we weren't there at their town meetings, in their congressional offices, in their state house offices, telling them about this. One instance was this, a resolution just passed by a member of the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Club, Ardina Clark, into the Los Angeles County Democratic Party, which identified the threat of the systemic collapse of investment banks such as Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch. This is a few days before the big blowout of Bear Stearns, I believe it was the 10th of July at the last LACDP meeting, which this resolution was passed. And then the wording was just that there's a systemic risk to the world financial system. And part of the resolution's clause was to educate the party about Franklin Roosevelt's Home Owners Loan Corporation and the types of mechanisms that he used to protect the general welfare of the population at the point of systemic breakdown in the early 1930s, which is really what we're getting into. Is this systemic collapse is happening right now, and we are going to have to deal with it. But my question would be to, I guess, Richie would be the most qualified answer, is we get asked from congressmen or from party leaders or people within state government, so what are we going to do? Okay, they understand, okay, yeah, Cheney must get removed. If he's removed, then, you know, we can probably do something. And they're for it. They just don't think that they're a little pessimistic about it actually happening. But how does the organization after the fact take place? Like, who decides which debt is erased of the hedge funds, of these derivatives markets, and which, you know, institutions, you know, debts are erased, mm-hmm. is my question to Richie.
Sure. I just want to say on this peck picture, the other side of it, I just say on the yen carry trade, that's about $1 trillion. It's underreported by a vast amount. And then that amount is borrowed at, say, 1% to 2% in Japan and Tokyo and invested in instruments here and elsewhere at 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15%. As that carry trade also punctures, and it is, and then you don't have that source of liquidity for all these other operations, even as they are starting to dry up. But I think, I'd say, Francisco, it's the following. When, and under these circumstances, this thing is happening so dramatically that I think, unless someone is completely blocked, and there are people who are in Congress and elsewhere, they can see it around them. I mean, they can even see it on the people living on the street who've lost their homes. And there are many other real physical economy and real life predicates and which this is happening, but they can read the news reports. Then it's a matter of the political process. As Lynn has said, the impeachment of Cheney is not the primary thing, although everything that, you know, you and Aaron said are absolutely essential about H.R. 333. It's getting him out. If there's a decision by certain people, including perhaps some senior adults, and they can get Bush away from Cheney by whatever process, getting him out of there, whatever way, Cheney has to report a heart attack, whatever, then you take some senior people under Lynn's guidance, or LaRouche's guidance, from the Republican and Democratic Party and say, look, this thing is so far advanced, we have to set up a series of emergency actions. We'll decide what these are. We'll consult with the senior leadership of the Democratic Party, bring Harry Reid in, bring McConnell in. But we're not looking for particular people. We're looking for the people who can move things in each party. And we will start to pass the emergency legislation in action. And again, LaRouche has come back time and again to what happened in when Pearl Harbor, the day before Pearl Harbor, December 6th, 1941, and the day of it. People's moods change. Let's cut the crap out. we better deal with this because we've got something huge on their hand. We've just had war declared on this. The financial system is declaring war just by its breaking down. At that point, you fashion legislation that goes through that can deal with it. Now, whether you have to change who controls the institutions. And by that I mean whether we keep the Federal Reserve as an institution or we replace it, make it a national bank. The key thing is who's setting the policy. If the policy is set, you then sit down with a group of bankers, people from the Federal Reserve, a committee representing workers, production-oriented businessmen, farmers, and you start sorting through the stuff. The first thing you declare on all institutions, as LaRusha said repeatedly, no foreclosures. You don't get thrown out. We may have to write the home from $500,000 to $200,000, but immediately no business gets shut, no farm gets shut, no person gets out of their home. And siding out the paper, you go to the bankers, and fundamentally, I mean, there's different mechanisms, which is why it's hard to say one single mechanism. It's the process is important, but this has happened, and I can tell you how. But you then sort down, and you say, okay, in this mechanism, you banks, we have some news for you. All your assets are worthless. So you're worthless. So you don't exist. Now, we will help you stay alive. But on the mortgages for $500,000 homes, they're going to be $200,000. Do you understand? Yeah. And the Fed can pass. And I'm not saying it has to be through the Fed, Francisco, but the Fed can pass. They have regulations A, B, C, Z. Marsha and I were discussing regulation Z the other day. They just passed a regulation that there will be a general policy of what will be accepted or not, and here are the guidelines in terms of credit. By the way, just so you'll know, just in the last few months, the Fed issued a credit warning to all banks as an instruction saying, this is our policy on not moving too fast on some of these things, but getting rid of some of the lending, which was completely ridiculous because you weren't even finding out whether people had jobs. You were just putting down that they did. So this can be done. You meet with the Treasury. At the same time, the United States is meeting with Russia, India, and China and saying, look, this system is gone. So we wipe out the hedge funds as an act of sovereign countries. We wipe out the Cayman Islands operation. Their sovereignty is – this thing is a British outpost. It doesn't exist.
Does this mean a new form of currency is going to have to take shape in terms of like what the United States uses? Like we're going to hand in all the dollars currently available, and how is that?
You don't have to hand in the currency. See, what you do – let me just say Bretton Woods because it's a fun thing. At the end of World War II, the United States had 42% of world production, 73% of world gold. And as a voluntaristic act, Roosevelt called the conference of all the nations. No one told him to. He just did it. And there he said, okay, we're going to have an arrangement of fixed exchange rates and credit direction to get capital goods, particularly to the third world, but also to reconstruct Europe, which is why the name of the World Bank is the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Reconstruction, Europe, Japan, development, third world. And we're going to set some currency alignments. And the actual values, the exchange cross rates are not the most important thing, but we're setting them because – look, the Italian lira was toilet paper. There was no Italy. Germany was a rubble field. There was no, at that time it was called the Reichsmark. It didn't exist. Germany was, it was just rubble all over the place, factories. Japan's yen didn't exist. So they, as a sovereign act of nations, based on the leadership of Roosevelt taking a voluntaristic action, they set the basis for currencies to be set, and they set certain rates between currencies. But the principle was no speculation, that these will have long-term rates so that you can trade, because if the rates are fluctuating every day, you don't even know what they are. You can't, businesses can't export and import. And the commitment to capital goods. You keep your currencies. But what you're really doing is you're recapitalizing your currencies. The mark became a currency because it was a commitment to redevelop and build Germany. So you make the production happen, which gives life to the currencies.
Francisco, one thing to throw in here, Richard's describing the process and some of the mechanisms. There's been some low-level mechanisms that are precedents for this. I'll just throw in, if depends on your age, you might know them. But agencies in the last 40 years came into play. For example, during the savings and loan period, it was set up that when this was a, this is part of a dirtier story. But certain federal-connected agencies would come in and decide what was on the books of a savings and loan agency and what could stay there and what couldn't. This was not – they were doing it for some bad reasons. But there was no problem in the mechanism of being able to create a committee or something to get together. Just like during the war on the positive side, when it came to ad hoc commissions to get a job done, not on finances, but on real production. States set up agriculture production boards of experienced people of any party, and they would decide what could be produced in their agriculture capacity that fit into a national war mobilization board. So the whole idea of my word, I'm just painting a picture. If there were impeachment proceedings announced, or if Cheney resigned, the mood of the country that could think up such precedents, including some of those grizzled old aides on Capitol Hill committees, there are those precedents by which then you could decide how to deal with this terrible emergency.
The Defense Plant Corporation was set up. It was set up in 1941 out of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. It funneled eventually $33 billion into the economy, which is a huge amount in those days. At two zeros and you have the equivalent of it today, it's several trillion dollars. They built up the machine tool sector. They reconverted the operations that were going on in auto factories so they would produce planes. They built magnesium plants. They built machine tool plants. Machine tool production went from 33,000 a year to over 300,000 units a year. They built more planes than you could possibly imagine. And this was done with the agreement of the government and the agreement of the Treasury, because that was said policy. And you could pass through Congress the result of the deliberation process. People have to know that they have a crisis. But once that comes up, you can embody this into legislation. And I would just remind our listeners that the Banking Reorganization, it wasn't called the Banking Reorganization Act, but the one that was first passed by Roosevelt in the first few days, he declared 1933, he declared a bank holiday on March 4th, and he opened the banks on March 13th. But the day before, he had the first session of Congress. This reorganization bill, which was not as ambitious as LaRouche's, but can have the same process, passed the Senate, the House, and was signed into legislation in a single day. So if the Congress gets the concept, there is no limitation in its powers, because those powers are derived, as Hamilton set them up, as he set up also the first national bank, from the implicit powers of the Constitution that were a system of credit and development, not a system of money. And the minute they make the decision, they have all the powers in the world if they will simply use them.
Well, I would say, I mean, part of this, like, recapitalization and, like, directing the credits into the types of infrastructure, you would see the nation redevelop, so these things in Minneapolis no longer occur. I mean, you got bright spots, like with the Tennessee Valley Authority recently with the repowering of the nuclear system there. You have in California the California High-Speed Rail Authority pushing this idea of linking the state up with rail. I mean, you still have this legacy of big projects within the United States, except they're very, like, dim. They're not on the forefront, shining for the whole world to see what we can actually do and the innovation, which, you know, we once were. But these things are seen in like Sacramento as something like, well, we can't. You know, it's so far off, we can't really do that. You know, in California, a budget has yet to be passed, and health care is going to be affected in a very terrible way with not getting these types of payments, which are necessary and whatnot. But it really is our role in the LaRouche Youth Movement and the work that Aaron's doing with the group out in D.C. to, you know, go in and educate these people that these types of things exist. This is LaRouche's program to go in and, you know, give it the type of energy in terms of, like, a credit formulation so that we can actually see these things through. And we really are, it seems, the only hope. I mean, I was at the YDA, the Young Democrats of America. I mean, and outside of, like, the frat parties that go on with young people our own age that are part of the system in the Democratic Party, I mean, there's no discussion about any of this outside of what the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing. And I'd like to point that out to the listeners, which we're having on the show today.
Yeah, Aaron, do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, I would actually, because one of the things I was thinking about is that there is right now sort of, because of the crisis and what we saw with this bridge collapsing, is that the Congress wants to react. There's a certain majority in the Congress that wants to react in a good way. But then you have these little pockets of things like with the Chris Dodd and Hagel putting these certain bills forward that are based on the Rohatyn infrastructure policy. And for us, as the LaRouche Youth Movement, we have to not only get a concept of what Lynn's economic program is, but also understand what the enemy's program is. And I'd actually like Richie to go into sort of the difference between a Rohatyn infrastructure policy versus what LaRouche is putting forward.
Well, I think that centers, Aaron, on, as you know very well, on the whole question of the long-term capital budget, that your budget is not based on your operating expenses. That's one side of your budget. But you have a budget which is for capital projects thought out over 50 years, as represented by LaRouche's next 50 years for the whole world, also next 50 years for the United States, and such things as the Bering Strait Rail Tunnel project. And therefore, you budget for this, $150, $250 billion. I don't want to set the time amount. Lynn will do that. But just to give people a sense, you're not talking a billion or 2 billion. And you then line up the things that need to be done. And Marcia knows very well on the bridges and on the hospital system, on the other types of things that have to be done. And you begin the outlaying process of 20 to 25 years. These projects will be paid back. And they won't even be principally paid back. And this is, again, very important. It's not a matter of saying, well, this rail project will pay back on its own within 20 to 25 years. It may or may not. But that the increased economic activity and the generation of new industries and of new cities and of population, like what would happen in Alaska if we build this Bering Strait project, of course, that will have world-shaking implications, that will generate a revenue base many times larger, the tax revenue base, than what you have expended in terms of the project. Now, this concept is one that has to get through to Congress, and I know the difficulties, that you build real physical production, that's the only worthwhile thing. That, and actually even more important, is the productive powers of labor, which creates that physical production, which makes such inventions and defines new capital goods by the scientific discoveries which are made, such as an isotope economy and the fission process, the fire of Prometheus through a fission process, and so forth. So that those power of labor has to be vastly increased. This is the cutting point, because this was understood under Washington, it was understood under Lincoln, it was understood under Roosevelt. And it's going to take a crisis which is way more advanced. Everything I gave at the beginning was only to sort of say two stress points. This is far, far more advanced. The panic falls of, you know, even the stupid stock market, which just had three straight weeks of fall. The last Friday was, of course, 284 points. This is a biggest three-week fall in 5 years, but that's just a foretaste. You have a total seizing up of credit. Now, the Rohatyn plan has certain features, and the principal feature that and we can go through the specifics is who controls. Under the LaRouche plan, the government decides policy with rational people. Will there be some outletting of some private contracts? Yes, that happened in the 30s. You can subcontract some of it. But the policy thrust in intent, the directionality, that is set by the government working with others, and then that policy can go through. The key point of the Rohatyn, without going into the details of how they would finance their bonds, because that's all secondary, it's not unimportant, but it's all secondary, is they would have the financiers control the revenue flows from whatever they built. And they would make those things, turn them into having to earn revenues, which on some of these instruments you really can't, but like highways and so forth. And they would lease them for 99 years, begin jacking up the fees, as they've done in the Dulles Toll Road, which is just a section in Northern Virginia, as they will do with Indiana, as they will do in Pennsylvania, as they will do in New Jersey. And these things will become prohibitively expensive because the financiers will control the revenue flows and policy direction. At the first pass of this thing, they will throw out the financiers, the financier oligarchs, Rohatyn, and the other syndicates, fascists like him, we'll throw out, oh, yes, this will be for the interest of everyone. But the principal point is that they will control the revenue flow and make many of the public infrastructure features unpayable. That is, the price will be so high, most people can't use them. It will be part of the deindustrialization. So I think that the who controls the policy is the biggest difference. If there's further questions, I could certainly answer. But that's really, I think, the cutting edge.
It also seems because the financiers right now are facing a big problem because of this credit bubble blowing out. And the banks themselves, for which they can enact these policies, are starting to fall into a crisis.
And they don't plan to build some of this stuff, Aaron. They want to take mostly existing infrastructure and loot it to death. Mm-hmm. They'll build a few other things if it's on their terms, you know, like the toll booths that used to pay in the feudalistic time. They will do that. Mm-hmm. But their principal thing is to take the existing assets like airports, toll railroads, and others, and just take up the price by fees and other impositions, tolls, and so forth, so that these things will be pushed further into the ground. Because the directionalities, these are the people who've looted this for the last 15 to 20 to 30 years and would not permit the long-term capital budget, which would have been essential through Congress. They beat it down every single time with some of their monetarist crazies. Well, how are you going to pay for this and use that so that right now the only option, say, for instance, in California, since they've been trying to build maglev for 20 years, is to do it privately. That's wrong. But they cut off all the viable options by shutting down the Hamilton-Roosevelt-LaRouche approach.
I had a question. With the blowout of all these investment banks, how does folks like Roet or people like Roetin expect to begin to use this system since it's already blown out, like to do all these things?
Because their objective is the Nazi system.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has to do with why the bully tactics of Cheney to keep Congress around, to get out wiretap. I mean, the police state isn't just some minor thing, right? It's all part of the thing, the policy.
If they're going to write off, look, in the financial collapse, you've got to be very clear. These guys, the inner core of the oligarchy, they'll watch the paper go. Their thing is to control power. Who controls the political power of the state and those now very reduced credit flows, like through the Bank for International Settlements in the 30s and whatever it would be today, that keeps them on top. And then what they will do is set up raw materials lootings. They will own the necessities of life, everything from power supply to food supply, which is part of what this cartelization process we've been seeing through globalization, which is all that globalization is, feudalism and cartelization. And then they will take the world population from about 6 billion people down to 2 billion, because they will control by fingertip control the human what is necessary for human existence. So their control of the system is they're not going to control the current system. In a certain sense, it's ironic because the current system cannot make it. It's either LaRouche's system based on production and development and the creative power of the human mind and so forth, or a fascist system. The current system, in any case, will never survive the next period. Those are the directions.
Let me throw in one thing here, Richard. You wanted to stress the breakdown side that's already taken place in the economy. You once said even congressmen can look around and you can see it. Of course, people have been blind. Besides the fact that President Bush has been given a script to say the economy is doing great, that's crazy. But what are the dimensions you're talking about?
Just a couple of other things, and then Aaron and Francisco may have a lot more on this than I do. But they, for example, they just announced car sales, and that's, cars greatly diminished. But General Motors, their change, they were down 22%, 19%. Ford, this is in July sales compared to what they were a year ago. Ford, 17% down. Even Toyota, 3% down. Honda, 3% down. If you look at some of the cars, the Chevy Silverado pickup, down 29%. The Ford F-Series pickup, 18%. The Corolla, which is Toyota's, 28.9%. So that's falling. And the job figures, which are just made up, the figures that come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Nonetheless, they could only even claim that they made 92,000 job creation in July. Unemployment went up to 4.6%. We know it's about 13.5 to 14% if you take real numbers and use that process. So that the physical side, out of which all of this loot and the rates of return would have to be to hold up the financial instruments, is also accelerating downward. And that bespeaks what's really at the heart of this whole system, that the physical side has been looted, but now even on with the credit side of these things not working out terribly well, they can't even hold that up. Just for example, this hedge fund Cerberus, which has has three-headed dog at the gates of hell as its symbol, they were taking over and have taken over just a few days, yesterday actually, a Chrysler. But the problem was that the investment banks led by J.P. Morgan tried to sell $12 billion of debt for the takeover. They couldn't do it because they said, well, we'll sell you junk bonds for 9%. Various people who looked at the financing say, well, you know, your debt service is going to be greater than your income stream. We don't want this. So they said 9.5%. Nope. 10.5%. Nope. 11.5%. Nope. So now J.P. Morgan and these banks are on the hook for 10 out of the $12 billion that they're going to have to supply themselves. Because they can't get, because of this credit seizing up, they can't get other people to finance the takeover. But the takeover went through, so they're not responsible for it. They say that we'll sell these instruments later in the summer when things pick up. Things aren't picking up. So this cannibalization process, we can just see a reflection of that. And, of course, in the housing market and in real incomes, which the real incomes are just absolutely collapsing.
Right. Well, go ahead.
And then also, I mean, if you add on Rohatyn's plan to basically have this private operation, then they have all these tolls and feudal-like principalities that run every infrastructure in the country. The population is not only losing its jobs, but in order to get anywhere, is increasingly being crunched.
Exactly. And to say that, Congressman, look, why do you think we didn't have infrastructure for the last 30 years? Rohatyn. Who did the actual plan for putting Delphi into bankruptcy to set off the chain reaction collapse?
Right.
We have his name on the signature. So you're going to put this guy in after what he's done for 35 years through through making the Democratic Party his fiefdom for the syndicate bankers behind him?
Yeah, and he issued in his own name a statement just this Wednesday, Felix Rohatyn, saying this is the way to go. Just like it's always worth looking again at his name on the documents. What year, Richard? 1975. The Municipal Assistance Corporation, Big Bank of New York City, that shut down, you can say, what, a third almost of all the fire halls?
Right. Every conceivable type of infrastructure. His history is so clear. It's really the matter of Lynn said, you have to have the courage to make a decision. The history is so clear of Rohatyn's collapse of infrastructure, collapse of basic industry, and so forth. And then saying, and Sarkozy is a great, I really like this guy who wants to blow up Iran and go to a war with Russia. So his history is clear on this thing. And it's a matter of, breaking from your cronies who are tied to popular opinion and shifting. I'm talking about congressional aides and others, and shifting to be able to be free of them so that you can think again, as we got Bush very briefly during the Kennedy-Bunkport summit when we got him away from Cheney and put adult supervision around him. And that's what we're going to have to do with some of these congressmen.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, Aaron, for Washington, D.C., we should just have a mini briefing book with the actual exhibits A, B, C, and D with the Rohatyn documents for what he's done. That's to hit someone over the head with it. It doesn't mean that, it's to give them a little courage, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing is things, Francisco, you're running for office in the Democratic Party in the Latino caucus in California, but Senator Barbara Boxer did say day before yesterday that she was going to hold a hearing, and she's head of the Senate Public Works Committee on the condition of infrastructure in the country. So bearing what Aaron and Richard were just saying about how you fund this, this may be an opportunity. This is whenever Congress reconvenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as far as the Latino caucus is concerned, I mean, there's a whole bunch of us in California. I know it's been mentioned before, Quincy O'Neill, member of the youth, is the vice chair of the African-American caucus and of the state party, and then Juanil Innocentes is the correspondent secretary for the Filipino caucus. It seems as though this I mean, over the years, like the Democratic Party, the metamorphosis into from Franklin Roosevelt into this Roatan, you know, free trade, you know, group in politics, is really like kept out this whole civil rights movement within the party, and it's corrupted it. I mean, you look at like with the Latino caucus and the current situation of it now, it's not even in existence in California because of the type of corrupt election procedures which were conducted at the state convention in terms of just trying to hand off power to, you know, selected people. And our presence within that process, you know, threw a wrench in the entire machine, and still to the, you know, the election which was supposed to take place and conducted at the convention in April still hasn't taken place, and we're waiting until November, and we're running a campaign for that, for my position of the Los Angeles vice chair, so we can begin to address these issues of, like, Roatan being, you know, so close to people like Pelosi, so close to people like Senator Dianne Feinstein out in California. But from the standpoint of taking the old guard of the civil rights movement within the party, you know, the Black caucus, the Latino caucus, I mean, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, the legacy of Cesar Chavez, who was a disciple of Dr. Martin Luther King to a large extent, we are really using this faction to break open the Democratic Party out there. I mean, and we've had success. People like Paul Kretz, one of the main opponents of Dick Cheney, he put out this idea that the California state party, our legislative arm, should pass a resolution to impeach Cheney, and this was about 3-4 years ago. So I mean, he was right on point at those types of things. Well, he is in dialogue with us. He's spoken before our club. The chair of the party, Art Torres, has asked to speak at our club, or he's going to be speaking at our club at the end of the month. And so you're seeing this type of you know, formation develop where party leaders are coming to us based upon what we're saying, what Richie's gone through in the years of work that he's put in. We're giving them the executive intelligence reviews. They're reading it. They're confused. They want to be educated. They see, you know, things that are breaking up, but they just don't really understand sort of how to situate it in their own minds. Like, what can we do? We're just a state representative, or we're just one single federal representative. We can't really do much. But it's really like our work on the ground with the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Club, with the youth, the LaRouche Youth Movement, you know, here in Houston, attacking Sheila Jackson Lee, getting her to sign on. But this wide, nationwide approach of getting young people out to shape the Democratic Party back into this legacy of Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, that brings us to a few seconds, in fact, and I think that's on message of what we have to do. Aaron, do you want to say anything particular about the month of the guns of August, as it's been called historically?
I would say to all the listeners that they should read and study LaRouche's economic platform that will be coming out and help mobilize the people that they know around these ideas.
Right, and that platform will be available on EIR online. The introduction to it is, well, it's still being written. It might be on the Rouge Pack already. If not, it'll be very soon. Richard?
Just two quick things. I think that many of the hedge funds which are buying many of the candidates, including, of course, Dodd, but others as well, they won't be there.
There you go.
Their power is gone. But the other thing I would say is we have a September 15th through 16th conference in Germany, and this is the four powers, Russia, India, China, and the United States, around the world development perspective. That's what's going to set the tone, and within that we can then do what we have to do in the United States.
Yes, I think like Francisco said about the regathering of the old guard now back to life, meaning they could be young too, but that kind of mission. And this is, Richard's referring to a Schiller Institute-sponsored conference in the Rhineland in Germany, September 15, 16. That's on the Schiller Institute website. So this does bring us to a conclusion. I thank Richard and Aaron and Francisco. Please listen August 11th, 2007, And the world will be very different then at the pace things are shifting. Thank you very much today. Closing off August 4th, The LaRue Show. This is Marcia Mary Baker. Thank you all very much.